Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to the final section of One Step Beyond. Again, tonight's broadcast, the December Surprise, the politics of terror and the exoneration of the secret team. We're going to take a look tonight, during the last section of the broadcast, at another interesting connection concerning the crash of Pan Am Flight 103, namely an interesting connection involving South Africa, Namibia, Angola, and the UN administrator for Namibia, currently a South African colony. The central aspects I think we want to think about in connection with the aspect of Flight 103 I'm about to look at concerns the fact that when the far right, when the U.S. national security establishment, of which the far right represents such an important part, decides to move, they decide to move, as I indicated earlier, when a move will scratch several different itches at once. In addition, I think the information that we're about to look at, this African connection or South African connection to the crash of Pan Am Flight 103, indicates the probability that this crime, this terrorist incident, came from the far right, in other words, from some of the Third Reich alumni to be found within the more reactionary elements of the U.S. national security establishment, specifically some of the world anti-communist-linked elements that figured so prominently in the Iran-Contra scandal, and that in turn have cropped up in connection with Nazi-linked and Palestinian terrorism over the course of the last 30 or 40 years. First article I'm going to read you comes from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, December 23rd of 1988. It's headlined, it's a Los Angeles Times story, Dateline London, headlined, U.S. had a tip on jet sabotage. Subheaded, it told airlines, not public. As officials said sabotage was the most likely cause of the explosion of Pan Am Flight 103 on Wednesday night, it was revealed that early this month, the State Department received an anonymous but detailed telephone tip that such an attack was coming. The department alerted all American diplomatic missions in Europe that a cell allegedly associated with the renegade Palestinian terrorist Abu Nidal intended before Christmas to smuggle a bomb onto a Pan-American World Airways flight originating in Frankfurt, U.S. and airline officials said. According to a copy of the alert, Pan Am had already been made, quote, aware of the threat information, unquote. The department instructed its missions that the warning, quote, must be passed immediately, unquote, to all other U.S. airline carriers serving Europe, but it forbade that the information be made available to the public. So bear in mind, the U.S. had advanced warning of this terrorist threat, that a Pan Am flight was going to be downed. There are some indications that the U.S. may have known just which flight went down. Consider the following. Again, not conclusive, but interesting, and I personally think very suspicious. Reading again from the San Francisco Chronicle, this from the previous day, Thursday, December 22nd of 1988. This is a story from the Chronicle Wire Services, Dateline, Syracuse, New York, headlined, 38 Syracuse students died in crash. We're going to ignore the Syracuse students here and take a look at another interesting detail. Skipping down in the story again, Chronicle 12, 2288. At the United Nations in New York, officials said Bernt Carlson, B-E-R-N-T, capital C-A-R-L-S-S-O-N, who served as chief administrative officer of the UN Council for Namibia since July of 1987, had died in the crash. He was on his way to New York for a ceremony today at which accords providing for Namibia's independence will be signed by Angola, Cuba, and South Africa. The officer is, in theory, the UN's appointed governor for Namibia, which is governed by South Africa. But because UN authority over Namibia is not recognized by South Africa, he is in practice the chief UN officer in charge of development programs intended to prepare Namibia for independence. So Bernt Carlson, the Swedish national appointed by the United Nations as the, in essence, the administrator for Namibia, dies in the crash of Flight 103. He was going to have been involved in the signing of an accord between Cuba, Angola, and South Africa concerning the withdrawal of Cuban troops from Angola and the granting by South Africa of independence to Namibia. An article about that accord signing was carried again, in the San Jose Mercury, the San Jose Mercury of Friday, December 23rd of 1988. This is from the Los Angeles Times. It's datelined the United Nations. It's headlined, Peace Plan Signed for Southern Africa. Amid a strong undercurrent of threats and barely concealed mistrust, Representatives of Angola, Cuba, and South Africa signed agreements Thursday intended to end the 13-year Cuban military intervention in Angola and bring about the independence of Namibia. While Secretary of State George Shultz, Soviet Deputy Foreign Minister Anatoly Adamishin, Adamishin, and UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar watched, the foreign ministers of the three nations signed a two-page document that was the product of 8 years of often bitter negotiations. Under the agreement, Namibia would achieve total independence of South Africa by April 1, 1990. Skipping down on the story, the celebratory nature of the signing ceremony was marred by the death of Bernt Carlsson, the UN administrator of Namibia, who was killed Wednesday in the crash of a Pan Am jet. And there's an interesting quote here. By signing this agreement, we have decided not to shoot it out. We have decided to talk. That by R.F. Pik Botha, B-O-T-H-A, the South African foreign minister who signed the agreement on behalf of South Africa. An interesting detail. Now remember that the UN administrator for Namibia, Bernt Carlsson, is killed in the crash. Incidentally, we're not covered here, but he was on his way to, among other things, the Bay Area, where he was scheduled for a speaking tour. Make of that what you will. An interesting detail concerning Flight 103 was carried in the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, December 22nd of 1988. Now, bear in mind, the U.S. has received a tip but didn't tell most people about it. This is an article from the Chronicle Wire Services. It's Dateline London, headlined, Pan Am Jet Crash Kills 273. A Pan American World... Well, I won't read you the introductory paragraph. Skipping down in the article, a South African embassy spokesman in London said that South African Foreign Minister Rolof Pik Botha had been scheduled to take the flight to attend talks at the United Nations on Namibia, but decided 2 or 3 days ago to take an earlier one. Once again, Chronicle 12/22/88, lead story. A South African embassy spokesman in London said that South African Foreign Minister Rolof Pik Botha had been scheduled to take the flight to attend talks at the United Nations on Namibia, but decided 2 or 3 days ago to take an earlier one. Well, again, one can't draw any conclusions from that, but it's interesting. Somebody, for some reason, Rolof Pik Botha decided to take a different flight. It's too bad for Bernt Carlsson. He didn't do the same thing. Again, no conclusions can be drawn, but it certainly is intriguing that the representative of the, in essence, fascist nation of South Africa managed to escape this particular conflagration. The UN administrator from Sweden did not. One wonders perhaps what might have prompted Rolof Pik Botha to take an earlier flight, whereas the other person who was supposed to have been present at the signing of the Namibia Accord was not there. Again, the actual conclusion of this broadcast will be wrapped up next week when the article from the Los Angeles Times mentioning Edwin Wilson's name in connection with the downing of Flight 103 will be brought up. Obviously, Wilson himself could not have done it since he's in Marion, Illinois Federal Prison, but we will conclude, we'll add that article as an addendum to this broadcast next week. Now we're going to take a couple of minutes and review what we've looked at, because this has been a very complicated, I realize, and at least for me, and I suspect for you also, an exhausting broadcast. We began by taking a look at the December 2nd, 1988 New York Times revelations concerning the bust of Pizza Connection 4, as we choose to call it, a drug smuggling bust which touches on many, many different aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal. We then took a look at a San Francisco Examiner story indicating that this bust involved the same cocaine for heroin switch, which appears to have figured prominently in Pizza Connection 3 in March of 1988 of this year. We then took a look at an article dealing with the crash of a plane killing former Israeli counter-terrorist advisor and Oliver North collaborator Amiram Nir. This appeared in the press the same day as the article about the bust of Pizza Connection 4. That very same day, we took a look at the decision by President Reagan, that this from the San Francisco Chronicle, although all papers carried it, the decision by President Reagan not to pardon Oliver North, but not to release any sensitive documents requested by North which would pertain or compromise national security. All of those articles from December 2nd. Of 1988. 2 days later, Washington Post story carried in the San Jose Mercury News reveals that because of the death of Amiram Nir, it can now be revealed that Amiram Nir and Oliver North had headed up a joint U.S.-Israeli counterterrorist operation in 1985 and 86, and apparently there are significant documents pertaining to that particular operation. We then took a musical break, and we took a look at the fact that several key CIA, State Department, and DIA counterterrorist experts died in the crash of Pan Am Flight 103. We took a look at the fact that maybe as many as 6 people died in that flight. We then took a look at a San Francisco Examiner story from December 23rd of 1988 linking Abu Nidal to that very same crash. Abu Nidal then surfaces 5 days later in Beirut, Lebanon, according to a report in the San Jose Mercury News. Abu Nidal linked to, among others, the very same terrorist incidents in 1985 and 86 that Oliver North and Amiram Nir were supposedly working against, although perhaps, according to one of our working hypotheses, Oliver North, at least, was working with those very same terrorists to create provocations. Certainly, Manzar El-Kassar, tabbed by Oliver North to help him secure weapons for the Contras, linked to Abu Nidal and Abu Abbas, both key players on the terrorist stage of 85-86. We then took a look at the death of Michael Bernstein, Justice Department investigator, who may have also been looking at elements related to the Iran-Contra scandal in one way or another. We then took a look at the dismissal of the conspiracy charges against Oliver North, as I hypothesized perhaps the bust of Pizza Connection 4, plus the deaths of the CIA, State Department, and DIA counterterrorist experts, in addition to the death of Amiram Nir, may have helped freeze some linebackers, so to speak, using that football metaphor. I suspect some people who might have been able to contribute information about the Iran-Contra scandal are less inclined to do so as a result of some of the corpses that have begun piling up. I think it can be said for sure that any documents pertaining to terrorists such as Abu Abbas, Abu Nidal, Manzar El-Kassar, any of the many bases touched by Amiram Nir and Oliver North in their Israeli-U.S. counterterrorist operations of 85 of 86 would have been deemed far too sensitive to be released to the Oliver North defense team. The El Iria situation, the Manzar El-Kassar situation, would have been among the many aspects of the investigation into the crash of Flight 103 that would have intersected with the Oliver North situation, with the Iran-Contra scandal. And certainly, any documents pertaining to U.S. counterterrorism would have been deemed far too sensitive for release under the circumstances of Flight 103. When that Abu Nidal connection was surfaced, from a practical standpoint, anyone could have forgotten about the possible release of these documents to the Oliver North defense team, thereby mandating the dismissal of the conspiracy charges. We also took a look at the fact that at virtually that same time, charges were dismissed against some people, including Adnan Khashoggi associates, people like Cyrus Hashemi, for arms smuggling, apparently in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. We then took a look at an article which we are going to include in the archives next week. We referred to an article in the Los Angeles Times mentioning the name of Edwin Wilson in connection with the downing of Flight 103. The Triple Wilson team, of course, front and center in the investigation into the Iran-Contra scandal. And we took a look at Muammar Gaddafi, according to many accounts, the current protege of Abu Nidal, and the recent military action against Gaddafi's air forces off the coast of Libya. Again, one wonders to what extent the downing of Flight 103 served to justify that in the minds of the American public. We took a look at the fact that the U.S. had a considerable advance warning of the impending terrorist attack, at least according to the accounts that have been made public. We took a look at the fact that Bernt Carlsson, the Swedish national appointed by the U.N. as the overseer for and the administrator for Namibia, was killed in that crash on his way to sign the Namibian Accord with South Africa and Angola and Cuba. However, Roelof Pikbota, the South African foreign minister who was there to have signed it with him, was scheduled to take the same flight but took an earlier one. Not conclusive, but indicative of perhaps the fact that the same World Anti-Communist League, Galen, Nazi-connected elements of our national security establishment and of the international reaction community, that those same elements may have been behind the crash of Flight 103 and not Palestinian terrorists as such, or at least PLO-linked elements. Because, again, I think the lay of the land with regard to the crash of Flight 103 suggests that it was the far right, and in particular elements of the American far right, some of the Wackel and Galen-related elements that benefited the most. And, again, I think once Flight 103 went down, the release of any of these sensitive documents was precluded, and I think certainly not only the judgment of the national security establishment, also popular opinion, would have sided with the Reagan administration to withhold any documents concerning counter-terrorist activities. And again, the CIA media asset, the Washington Post, surfaced the existence of just such documents 2 days after the crash of Amiram Near. I think, indeed, quite a few linebackers were frozen by this scenario. Next week, we will conclude with the inclusion of the LA Times article. Now, all of the archive shows featured on, all of the archive shows alluded to on these broadcasts, as well as the program that I've just put into the archives this evening. And again, it's going to be called The December Surprise, The Politics of Terror and the Exoneration of the Secret Team. All of the archive shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication service. The name of that duplication service is Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio, P.O. Box 17-0023, Box 17-0023. That's in San Francisco, zip code 94117-0023, 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840, 415-346-1840, right? Or phone to the attention of Paul. And again, neither myself nor the station makes money off of this arrangement. That's Archives on Audio, Box 17-0023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. 415-346-1840. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks so much for listening. Good night. Take care of yourselves. And again, I hope the information tonight has been made clear enough. I realize it's a complicated thesis that I've been presenting, a complicated working hypothesis. Elements of it are certainly speculative, and I'd be the first to admit it, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. But I think the fact that Flight 103's crash would have precluded the release of the North counterterrorist documents, I think, can be put in the bank. As I say, the December surprise, the politics of terror, and the exoneration of the secret team. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Well, welcome to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. This evening, I'm going to complete the December surprise, as I titled this program last week. The first part of tonight's prepared portion, in fact, perhaps all of tonight's prepared portion, is going to go into the archives along with last week's broadcast, and the title, for those of you who either are listening in your car or for some reason have not been able to tape the program, the title at Archives on Audio is The December Surprise, The Politics of Terror and the Exoneration of the Secret Team. The term secret team, by the way, refers to what the Christic Institute, a public interest law firm that has filed a suit against many of the key players in the Iran-Contra scandal. That is what they term this group of people, this group of veteran intelligencers who have been involved in many, I would say most, of the major intelligence scams over the last quarter century or so. The term, by the way, was borrowed from Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, former Air Force focal point officer, who used the term secret team as the title for his landmark book about the U.S. intelligence agencies in calendar year 1969. I'm going to give you a rundown now of what we're going to listen to. We're going to begin with a column from the San Francisco Examiner by Mary McGrory, a nationally syndicated columnist, in which she ruminates about the significance of Bob Woodward of the Washington Post's disclosure that the late Amiram Near, an Israeli counterterrorism expert, and Oliver North had cooperated on joint U.S.-Israeli counterterror operations in calendar years 1985 and 6. Most of what could be subsumed under the Iran-Contra scandal, or most of the aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, I should say, could be subsumed under the name counterterrorism, and no doubt have been. We're going to take a look at Mary McGrory's speculation concerning the significance of Bob Woodward's disclosure. We hinted at that significance last week. In fact, hinted, I stated very repeatedly that disclosure revealed the existence, in all probability, of documents, very important documents concerning the United States and Israel's cooperation perhaps in opposing terrorism, or, as I indicated, in all probability, causing terrorism, or at the very least, permitting it for strategic reasons. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about one of the most fascinating connections from the Iran-Contra scandal, one which emerged in the New York Times the day before I did last week's broadcast. However, because of the fact that I frequently get behind in my newspaper reading due to the number of papers that I have to read, I didn't read about this till after last week's broadcast. Indeed, the papers concerning the Danish ship ERRIA, E-R-R-I-A, and the weapons shipped aboard it were indeed some of the key documents that were being requested by Oliver North and that were denied by President Reagan, and that served as the excuse, at least partial excuse, for the dismissal of charges against Oliver North, or some of the charges against Oliver North this past week. We're going to take a look at that next. Following that, we're going to take a look at an interesting article from the Los Angeles Times in late December of 1988, which mentions the name of Edwin Wilson in connection with the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 that scattered the remains of some 258 people all over the town of Lockerbie, Scotland, and killed several townspeople as well. Edwin Wilson's name has been mentioned in connection with the apparent barometric fuse device that was believed by counter-terrorist experts to have set off the bomb that destroyed Pan Am Flight 103. We'll then look briefly at the fact that the documents Oliver North was requesting were indeed relevant to CIA agents and the identities of CIA agents currently in operations around the world. We're then going to look very briefly at a Jack Anderson column which maintains that, in fact, the main focus of the Central Intelligence Agency, at least according to Jack Anderson, who, in my opinion, in all probability, works for the Central Intelligence Agency and is in a position, therefore, to know, that indeed the bombing of Flight 103 is now one of the hottest, if not the hottest, items on the CIA agenda. We're going to take a look, too, at the judge, Gerhard Gesell's, turning down of documents offered to him by the Christic Institute, the public interest law firm that I mentioned at the beginning of this introduction and that I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with. We're also going to take a look at an interesting article which came out yesterday concerning the fact that John Hull, one of the key figures in the Christic Institute's suit, was arrested on drug smuggling charges in Costa Rica. The charges of drug smuggling have been leveled by many people, including members of the Christic Institute in their suit. Following that, we're going to take a break, a musical break. Then we're going to take a look at an interesting coincidence of events, if indeed one could call it a coincidence. We're going to ruminate about the interesting synchronization of a number of things having to do with, apparently for not for much longer, U.S. Prosecutor Giuliani. Rudolph Giuliani, who has announced his retirement in New York. And we're going to take a look at some of the cases he was involved in. He, of course, was very much involved in the Pizza Connection case. There are now four Pizza Connections, although I believe they're all part of the same operation. And that Pizza Connection 4, as we termed it last week, appears to be a major element in the maneuvering, which I have termed, under my working hypothesis, again, the December surprise, the politics of terror, and the exoneration of the secret team. We're going to take a look at a couple of the cases that former prosecutor, or soon-to-be former prosecutor Giuliani was involved in, including a fascinating stock manipulation case concerning GAF. GAF stands for General Aniline and Film. That, however, is a name that was adopted relatively late by that company. We're going to take a look at a little bit of the history of General Aniline and Film. Was formerly known as American IG. It was the American subsidiary of the huge Nazi chemical cartel, huge Nazi chemical conglomerate, IG Farben, which had many, many cartel agreements with key U.S. firms and other firms all around the world. Interestingly enough, the failure of Rudolph Giuliani to successfully prosecute GAF is being cited as one of the possible reasons for his sudden resignation. He's being mentioned as a possible Republican candidate for mayor to run against Ed Koch of New York City. The dismissal of the GAF case happened because, according to all accounts, the prosecutor, Rudolph Giuliani, withheld information which could have helped the defense. Now, interestingly enough, GAF was represented in this case by none other than Arthur Lyman, the key the key congressional counsel, who rather tepidly posed questions to the various defendants during the public hearings on the Iran-Contra scandal in 1987. Arthur Lyman, a fascinating person, and we will talk about some of his many, many connections during the course of the broadcast. We will then examine some of the history, a short piece of history concerning General Aniline and film, and just what it was that encouraged American I.G. Farben to change its name to General Aniline and film. Basically, it was the outbreak of World War II and the attendant negative publicity that the Third Reich enjoyed because of it. We will then take another musical break, and in light of the fact that today, and today for the benefit of those people who eventually hear this program on tape, is January 15th of 1989. This is the weekend in which America observes the holiday, the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We're going to take a look at just how far Dr. King's unfulfilled dreams have fallen, and we're going to take a look at, first of all, a very important and eloquent column by James Michener, who sees in the campaign waged by George Bush, quoting directly now, ominous signs of American fascism. And myself and before me, Mae Brussel, has been maintaining for a long time that, in fact, America is going fascist. And although that is an assertion which has met with a good deal of ridicule in certain circles, in particular progressive political circles have been quite contemptuous of that notion. Now even a hard-nosed Cold War liberal like James Michener is beginning to recognize the writing on the wall that, in fact, America is, by degrees, ever so slowly, turning fascist, is turning into the Fourth Reich. We're then going to look at two chilling articles which I think measure the extent to which fascism has come to certain institutions in this country. This is not a fascist country yet. Many of its institutions are, including its most powerful institutions, and if this trend continues, I think people are going to find themselves living in a nightmare. We're going to take a look at a chilling article researched for us by a listener, this from the Deseret News of Salt Lake City, about the Ogden Police Department, that's Ogden, Utah Police Department, hearing lectures concerning the international Zionist-Marxist conspiracy and the inferiority of blacks, the racial inferiority of blacks. They are hearing this from an Aryan Nation spokesman, although he maintains he's not connected with them. I think it's pretty clear that he is part of that same political milieu and has documented connections to the Hayden Lake people. We're then going to take a look at an article in a similar vein from today's San Jose Mercury News, in which the San Bernardino, California Police Department has been experiencing some very disturbing racial troubles, and specifically, the Aryan Police Officers Association has been harassing black political recruits. That's what we have on tap for this evening, and, well, here we go. Let's begin with the first of our articles. The first of these stories comes from the San Francisco Examiner of December 8th, 1988. This is a column by Mary McGrory, and it's Dateline Washington headline, A Paper Trail to Freedom. It is now considered bad form in Washington to talk about events that occurred before November 8th. Any references to the Iran-Contra scandal, which occurred a century ago in the current memory frame, are out of order. So are recollections of the nasty campaign conducted by the president-elect. But the past does intrude. Now, Amiram Nir, the Israeli counter-terrorist official and man about the arms deal who declined to appear before the Iran-Contra committee, has testified from the grave. Nir, who was deeply involved, Oliver North has fingered him as the perpetrator of the diversion scheme, died in a mysterious plane crash over Mexico last week. But last June, he gave a long, hold-for-release interview to the Washington Post's Bob Woodward. Why? We do not know. Nir claimed there was a U.S.-Israeli agreement that authorized certain undercover joint operations. The White House and the State Department swear they can't find any document in support of his claim. If found, it could form an umbrella over North's contention that he was at all times carrying out official policy. Here's a very important paragraph. The mere mention of its possible existence could make it even more unlikely that North will ever stand in the dock. His lawyers could add the phantom paper to the 3,500 classified documents they are already seeking as essential to his defense. The fight over the documents has dragged on for months. The interagency group that decides on their fitness for exposure is contesting the inclusion of facts that are already on the public record. That last sentence again. The interagency group that decides on their fitness for exposure is contesting the inclusion of facts that are already on the public record. The judge in the case, the redoubtable Gerhard Gesell, a pillar of rectitude and legal correctness, is operating under the assumption that the President of the United States is anxious to see that justice is done in the case of a former subordinate whom he regards as, quote, a national hero, unquote. His Honor warned the President that he will bear the burden of calling off the trial if he withholds vital defense evidence. Reagan promptly and even proudly responded that he could not possibly authorize the release of documents that would reveal state secrets. Far from fearing that he will be seen by history as a chief executive who quashed the trial of a man who could embarrass him and even call him as a witness, the commander-in-chief once again wrapped himself in the Patriot's mantle. It's the perfect way out. It would relieve Reagan of the tedium of pardoning North. It would also excuse George Bush from the same dilemma. Thus, there would be no blot on Reagan's exit as a world peacemaker and Bush's entrance as a domestic healer. And the country would be spared the spectacle of a Marine who now gets $25,000 per lecture doing time. Well, there are a number of things to comment on in this column. First of all, this column points very distinctly towards exactly the same working hypothesis that I have been presenting in the course of this two-part archive show. Again, the December surprise, the politics of terror, and the exoneration of the secret team. Now, recall some of the information covered last week. On December 2nd, three key stories broke in the American press. First of all, the announcement of the plane crash killing Amiram Nir. That same day, there was a very, very important article dealing with a huge, huge mafia narcotics bust, which we termed Pizza Connection 4. This is the third case growing out of the original Pizza Connection case. The first Pizza Connection case was a mafia and P2-related organized crimes heroin smuggling operation in which the proceeds from this heroin smuggling operation were laundered through two key U.S. brokerage houses, E.F. Hutton, whose head for much of that time was Scott Pierce, George Bush's brother-in-law, and Merrill Lynch Pierce Fenneron Smith, whose head for much of the time this was going on was none other than Donald Regan, up until a year or two ago, White House Chief of Staff. The Pizza Connection case also hooks up directly, and for our purposes here, very importantly, with, among other things, the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring intersecting not only with the U.S. and Italian national security establishments, but NATO in general, and the assassination of the Pope, as we looked at in Radio Free America shows 20, 25, number 32, and number 34, including some key supplements to number 34, Stibom and its attendant scandals, and there are a number of scandals related to Stibom, spelled S-T-I-B-A-M, was a key element not only in the Iran-Contra scandal, but also in the shooting of the Pope as well. Theodore Shackley, one of the people accused by the Christic Institute in their suit, was, according to an article in Europeo magazine from August 17th of 1985, working with Giuseppe Santavito of Italian intelligence and the fascist P2 Lodge, months before the Pope was shot, and this at a time when the Kremlin and Vatican were achieving a significant diplomatic rapprochement that would have worked against the interests or perceived interests of the United States and the more reactionary elements of the Italian national security establishment. And that can be translated, by the way, P2, Propaganda Due, the Masonic Lodge, founded by Licio Gelli, an Oberleutnant in the SS during World War II. The P2 Lodge has literally served as a crypto-fascist government running Italy for a long time, and Licio Gelli and others in P2 have massive critical connections to the U.S. national security establishment. The names of President Reagan and former President Nixon emerged in the Stibom case. And again, on December 2nd, in addition to the Pizza Connection case breaking, in addition to Amiram Nir breaking, or the death of Amir Amnir breaking, that same day, President Reagan announced that he just couldn't release any documents which would reveal state secrets. 2 days later, on December 4th, all three of those first articles appeared in the American press on December 2nd. 2 days later, the story broke in the Washington Post and other papers that Bob Woodward, an interesting fellow known for his connections to U.S. naval intelligence in the past, as well as for his less than zealous pursuit of the Watergate case, although he and Carl Bernstein are credited with breaking the Watergate case, in fact, the most important aspects of Watergate never saw light, at least not in their copy. And interestingly, Bob Woodward revealed the existence of this secret U.S.-Israeli counter-terrorist operation in 1985 and 86, 2 days after Amir Amnir went down. And in fact, as we read last week, the death of Amir Amnir made the Washington Post feel they could release the story. They didn't want to talk about it when he was alive. Well, he went down on the 2nd. The Pizza Connection 4 case broke on the 2nd, and thereby and Amir Amnir went down on the 2nd. Reagan announced that he would not release the documents on the 2nd. The revealing of this joint U.S.-Israeli agreement on the 4th made it probable that many, many key documents concerning U.S. counter-terrorist operations would be requested by Oliver North, because many of the aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal intersected directly with one aspect or another of those counter-terrorist operations. Now, for our purposes here, the most significant of those operations, in my opinion, was the IRIA operation. Now, a whole bunch of Soviet Kalashnikov assault rifles were shipped to the United States aboard the Danish ship IRIA, E-R-R-I-A. Now, the most fascinating aspect of this, in my opinion, and the most significant, in my opinion, is the fact that the major weapons broker, or one of them, at the European end, or actually Middle Eastern end, was a fellow named Manzer El-Kassar, described in the popular press as not only a drug dealer, but also an arms supplier and terrorist associated with, and this is very important, not only Abu Abbas, a radical Palestinian affiliated not only with neo-Nazi elements, but connected with such terrorist incidents in 1985 and 86 as the Achille Lauro hijacking, in which an American Jew, and a disabled American Jew at that, Leon Klinghoffer, was thrown overboard. I'm sure many people remember that particular incident. In addition, Manzer El-Kassar is connected with Abu Nidal, the Palestinian terrorist who has been described as an anti-Arafat radical. It's also been suggested that he's an Israeli and perhaps American agent provocateur, a hypothesis I favor personally. And it should be noted here that both Abu Nidal and Abu Abbas were key players on the international terrorist stage during calendar years 1985 and 86. It should also be noted that the IRIA deal was brokered at part of the European end, was handled by a company called Merex. Merex is an arms shipping company founded by a former Otto Skorzeny associate named Gerhard Mertens. In fact, the company Merex has served as a front for Galen Organization weapons shipments to, among other things, extremists and terrorists in Europe, specifically Italian and third position P2 linked terrorists. Taking a look at that in Radio Free America shows. Well, we actually took a look at Merex in Radio Free America 19, part of the Pope shooting series. We came back to Merex in a big way in Radio Free America number 32, and again in a supplement to Radio Free America 34. Otto Skorzeny, of course, Hitler's commando chief during World War II, a fellow who jumped to the CIA along with Reinhard Galen, Hitler's intelligence chief for the Eastern Front during World War II, who jumped to the CIA with, for all practical purposes, his entire organization. That organization became, in turn, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. Then it became, for all practical purposes, the NATO intelligence organization. And finally, it became the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German Intelligence Service, which it is to this day, with the former junior members, the guys who were 23 and 24 at the end of World War II, who still had many, many years, or still had a lot of combat experience due to the depletion of German manpower near the end of the war. Those people are now the senior officials. Obviously, Galen and some of the older people have passed on to their ultimate reward. Interestingly enough, Otfried Hepp, a prominent German neo-Nazi and a third-position fascist, is very closely affiliated with Abu Abbas, a fellow who, again, is one of the two main terrorists associated with Manzer al-Qasar. Now, one of the main theses that we have been entertaining over the years on this program, and one of the most important of the many pieces of landmark research done by Mae Brussel, is that the U.S. national security establishment, largely due to the influence of the Gehlen organization at the end of World War II, has adopted as a main strategic ploy what is known as provocation. Provocation is when you set up a terrorist incident or an incident to be blamed on one's opponent. This serves to not only discredit the opponent, but frequently to serve as a pretext for action. We've taken a look at that in a number of archive shows. Mae Brussel developed that in her landmark article in The Realist in 1974, The SLA is the CIA. Mae, in studying the machinations of the Reagan gubernatorial administration here in California, had correctly deduced that the terrorist incidents and the many California violences, as she called them, the SLA, the Manson family, the People's Temple, the Zebra Killer, the Zodiac Killer, etc., that many of these things were in fact being set up by the government in order to justify the establishment of police state and fascist tactics, specifically a denial of civil liberties. When the Reagan administration, when Reagan moved to Washington, that same scenario, the scenario of provocation used by the Third Reich at the Reichstag fire to obtain dictatorial powers, used by the Third Reich at the Gliwice border station with Poland to justify their invasion of Poland, and many, many other provocations figured prominently in the history of the Third Reich, that tactic has been employed in a big way by the United States. We're now going to turn over this cassette tape. Those of you who are listening by tape, we'll hear the rest of this program on the other side.